Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, today is the third Monday of the month, of the third month of the year, if you can believe that already. But on the third Monday of the month, we typically look at business, career, lifestyle, work-life balance issues. And today is no exception on that. Coming up around 12:20, we'll be talking with Dr. Tasha Urich, who says if work-life balance feels like an ancient myth to you, then stay tuned and find out what she has to say on that. She's going to give us some productivity tips that will help us get out of the office more this summer so we have more playtime. And that sounds good to me. Coming up at the end of the show, we'll be talking with Brian Felko, author of Driving to Perfection. And we're going to talk there specifically about when your boss is a bully. It's absolutely staggering numbers. People being bullied at work. I was really shocked looking at this survey that just came out. 27% of U.S. employees have been bullied at work. 55% of those said the boss was their bully. So we'll be asking some questions of him about how we can deal with that. And first, coming up, another meaty subject here, because this affects many, many, many people. We're going to be talking about transitioning from the military to civilian service. And my first guest has written a great book to help others successfully make that transition. He's done it himself. His book is called Boots to Loafers, Finding Your New True North. And also there's contribution in there from human resources executive and best-selling author Paul Falcon. So let me tell you a little bit about my guest, and I'll let him fill us in on the other details. He's Lieutenant Colonel John W. Phillips, retired. He had a distinguished 20-year career in military service and went on to create more success in civilian service. After retiring from the military in 1999, he immediately began a new career with a Coca-Cola company. He's currently a mid-level finance executive. And in addition to this position, he's also the founder and chairman of the Coca-Cola Company Annual Veterans Day Program and co-founder and president of the Coca-Cola Company Military Veterans Business Resource Group. I'd like to welcome Lieutenant Colonel John Phillips to the show. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, let's begin with this, because there are some staggering numbers around this, too. The average rate of unemployment amongst people who've come out of the military is actually 4% higher than the national average, as I understand it. Cost of unemployment compensation for troops leaving the military without jobs approached $1 billion in 2011. I don't know how that's changed, whether it's gone up or down. And yet nearly 60% of companies surveyed mentioned difficulties understanding veteran resources. So let's use that as our starting point. And you tell me a little, let's just look a little bit your background and why, what kind of fears you faced when you came out of the military yourself.
Well, I mean, stepping out of, I've been around the military my entire life. My father was served in the military. He was in the Army for 30 years. So I have moved and lived all over the world pretty much my entire life. So it's really all I really knew. So after my career came to an end in 1999 and I retired and I stepped out of my boots and into loafers, I mean, I was stepping into a world I had no knowledge about other than what I read about in college and what was, you know, taught to me on theory and things like that. So, yeah, I was scared because I really didn't know what to expect. And I've kind of learned through the school of hard knocks what to do, what not to do, how do you do certain things. And what I started doing is taking notes on all these things. And the notes turned into a notebook. And that's when I decided I need to put this in book form. And that was how Boots to Loafers started.
One of the things you say in there is, you know, in the military, you work very hard to get all these honors and decorations and awards, and they come out and they just don't translate into the private sector. So you say, you know, be proud of what you've done for your country and leave it there.
Yeah, I kind of, you know, the book is really plain spoken. It's like I'm having a conversation with you about certain aspects of what you're going to have to go through. And in this particular case, if you're highly decorated, if you're a high-ranking officer, a high-ranking non-commissioned officer, even a middle grade, or even a first-termer, you may have a lot of awards and decorations. You may have a lot of awards and decorations for valor in combat and gallantry. Don't take it as disrespect if someone doesn't understand what that means.
Mm-hmm.
Set it aside. Get over it. The first thing you need to do as part of your transition and your personal transformation is you got to get over it. People, don't take it personal. People just don't understand. If you look at the country, less than 1% of the people in the United States have ever served in the military.
Mm-hmm.
So the person that you're sitting across the table from when you're interviewing, if you get to the interview stage in finding a job, they probably have not served in the military, and what they know is what they hear on the radio or what they see in the movies or what they see on the news. That's
right,
it.
Right, and they don't understand.
They don't.
Significant differences in certain areas. As I was going through the book, you know, communications style is one. You know, and I think this is true when you move around from company to company. Every single company has its own jargon, and that's one of the big challenges to overcome. Let's look a little bit about what you did in the military, if we can, John, and how you translated that into civilian workforce to make yourself, your skills transferable, because that's really what it's all about.
Well, I was a field artillery officer, so what I had to do when I was in uniform, I had to do a lot of coordinating and collaborating. So I had to talk to everybody and their brother before I shot the first round downrange. And I think those in your audience that are in the military would understand that, whether it be the Air Force people, which you have to talk to, because it's a very big, well, we used to joke about it and say, big sky, little bullet. We don't have to talk to the Air Force guys. But, you know, you may have that one time where that bullet hits the airplane and it's not a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the bullet happens to be 200 pounds. But so you have a lot of people you have to talk to. Those skills of collaborating and coordinating with various levels within the organization, whether up and down the chain or across horizontally, are extremely transferable in being able to communicate. The hard part about the communicating is the military is very direct and to the point. And frankly, when you get very direct and to the point in the private sector, my experience has been you start hurting people's feelings because they feel like you're mad at them or something. And
right, right.
All you're really doing is giving them, well, you're not ordering people anymore either. You're kind of directing them and asking them. And, you know, there's a little short piece I have in the book about the first time I was ever asked how I felt about something. Was I comfortable with it? And I almost fell out of my chair because I've never been asked that before in my life.
Yeah.
And I was like, you're kidding me, right?
Yeah. Well, I was really taken going through the book, as I said, just how many differences there are, because you're right. We don't, as civilians, we understand there's going to be a transition because you're kind of locked into this mentality, and then you come out and it's less black and white, as you say in the book. Out here, there's a lot more gray area. The culture is entirely different.
Yeah.
So when you're talking with people about this, and I know you cover this in the book, but what would you say are the top three most common challenges that you see people going through as they make their transition?
I think the first is what we just talked about, is communication. You really need to work on how you communicate with people. You've got to be able to adjust the way you communicate with certain people inside an organization. The second are the cultural differences. There are cultural differences. You know, you can, it's like you said earlier when we started the program, everyone has their jargon and acronyms and everything. It's going to be no different when you get into the private sector. I mean, where I work now at Coca-Cola, it is a completely different language here. And sometimes they have an acronym that is the same as the acronym we may have used in the military. And, of course, my mind goes straight to the military acronym, and I'm lost. Mm-hmm. I have no idea what they're talking about. But one of the big cultural differences that I have noticed is you can actually ask a question if you don't understand something, and you're not identified as being weak because you don't understand something. Mm-hmm. That's pretty different, because sometimes you can get labeled in the military very quickly. And I think the third big one is probably your situational awareness, really understanding your surroundings. Use the training that you were given while you were in the military to really observe, listen, and see what people are doing, see what, how they're dressing, how are they talking, how are they acting, everything like that, because you have got to go through a personal transformation or rebrand yourself. You're not a soldier anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, and you talk extensively about this in the book. One of the other things you say is finding the balance between home and work, because in the military, they own you, what, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, as I understand it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can remember when I was stationed at Fort Campbell with the 101st Airborne Division, we had, when we were on green cycle, I could only go 100 miles, up to 100 miles away, because if we got the call, we had to be back at post very quickly, because we were loading out. And we would be wheels up in 18 hours. That was what was happening. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to worry about any of that. But I speak to this in a book about a work-life balance. It's interesting you have a guest coming on that talks about that. I truly believe in having a work-life balance. I actually come out to your part of the country, and I go fly fishing. I go whitewater rafting. And I live my life, and I get out and see the country, because when I was in the military, I was in lockdown a lot of times, mm-hmm. Yeah. And I just couldn't do it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you say that the military knows how to, quote, turn you on and get you fired up for a mission, and transitioning out of boots will require the same focus to get you fired up for your next mission, which is getting a job. So mentally, how can people best prepare themselves? And this doesn't just affect somebody coming out of the military. It obviously affects their families, too, that they're living with.
Oh, yes. It affects the, but think about this, the current generation that is in the military right now. They've been fighting for 12, 13 years. You know, almost every other year they're deploying. If they're not, they're getting ready to deploy, or they're coming home. That wears on a family. So you take that operational tempo that they've been under for the last 12 to 13 years, and all of a sudden, let's say they just get out of the military or they retire, they get a civilian job. Now they're not going anywhere anymore. That can cause some tension in the house, because, you know, mom or dad are used to you being gone.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to be able to sit down with your spouse or significant other or whatever, and you've got to have a conversation, and you got to make sure you both of you are on the same sheet when it comes to how things are going to be in the house and things like that. And it's a struggle. I've been through it a couple of times, and it is a struggle, and you've got to work together in that.
Yeah.
But it is an effort, and it goes back to the whole transformation and rebranding of what you've got to do. It is not easy. Just because you're a veteran doesn't mean someone's going to hand over a job to you. It is not. Look at the competition. There are a number of people out here that are unemployed that have a ton of civilian experience. You've got to be the cut above that.
Right, right. And you talk about all these great skills that you've had, like, you know, punctuality for one. You know, you called in ahead of time. Some of our guests leave it right to the last minute if they call. All of these skills that people may not think about that are transferable can actually put you a step ahead of,
absolutely,
of civilians. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. So let's look a little about the book. I just want to talk about how this is broken down and why it's broken down this way. It's broken down into three segments, basically: transition, transformation, and integration. So talk to us a little bit about
The transition really, if you know you're going to be getting out of the military, what I would say is the absolutely minimum in the ideal situation would be is you need to really start your transition process about a year out. And by that, I mean you need to pull out all of your efficiency reports, your OER, officer efficiency reports, NCOERs and things, and you need to start pulling out everything you did. And I give some examples of a format that I have used that's called STAR, S-T-A-R,
mm-hmm.
and it's situation task. So what was it you did? A is the action. What is it you specifically did? And then R is the result. And if you can organize your thoughts in that way, you do two things. Number one, you help organize your thoughts so you can start to develop your resume. Your resume is going to take you a long, long time to demilitarize. And then the second thing, it's going to organize your thoughts so when you sit down at an interview and someone asks you a question, your thoughts are already organized. And if you give them the response in the STAR format, now you've given them a complete answer. That's
right.
Extremely important.
Right.
And then the book moves into transformation, which is basically rebranding. So you've got, as the analogy I use a lot of times is, you can't move into an interview and come across as a steely-eyed killer because they're not going to hire you.
Right.
You got to lighten up, and you got to set all of that aside. And the mission at hand is to get through the interview, answer the questions, ask for the job, and then get the call up to get the job offer. And then that moves you into the integration piece where you are actually integrating yourself into the company you're moving into. And in that chapter, I deal with a lot of things that are like employment law, which is rather boring, but it's very, very important.
Yeah. Well, I've not been in the military myself. I've not been around it, but I've hired thousands of people over the years, and I do think this would be very beneficial to anybody making that integration.
Thank you. I've had a lot of people tell me that this book is not necessarily for military. It could be for a college student moving out because they don't teach this stuff in any bachelor's degree program or master's degree program. They don't teach you how to interview.
Right, right.
They don't go through any benefits.
Right. And I want to just, we're almost at the end of our segment, so I want to just say here, there's a Chinese proverb you share in the book. It says, learning is a treasure that will follow its owner everywhere. And one of the things you stress in the book is take advantage of that GI Bill to get as much education before you leave the military as you can.
Absolutely. I mean, I got my bachelor's degree on GI Bill. I was an enlisted man before I was an officer. And I got my master's degree while I was in the military, and Uncle Sam paid for that too. Never, ever forget this. There's one thing no one can ever take away from you. They can never take away your education.
Yeah. Well, I think there's great advice. You just shared great advice with our listeners. There's wonderful advice in this book and on your website. The website is bootstoloafers.com, bootstoloafers.com. And the book, again, is called Boots to Loafers, Finding Your New True North. And it's all about transition, transformation, and integration. And I was interested in there to see that you say, you use an example of in here where you say being is more important than doing sometimes. And I interested to see that. Thanks for being with us. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. It's also available on Amazon.
Wonderful. Thanks so much.
So they can go out there. Thank you, ma'am.
And that, my guest, of course, Lieutenant Colonel John W. Phillips, his book, Boots to Loafers, Finding Your New True North. And please do stay with us. When we come back, we'll talk about being more productive in the office so we can spend less time there and more time outside playing. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Something for me. Something you call love, but confess. You've been a-messin' where you shouldn't have been a-messin'. And now someone else is getting all your best. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Hi, I'm Pat Pauley. Tune into my show, Get Active, each Tuesday at 12 noon on Alternative Talk 1150. Each week, we invite a guest to talk about one of the wonderful activities in the Puget Sound region, ones that you may want to participate in. We'll focus on how adult beginners can comfortably get into all of these activities. You'll learn a lot about how you can get active. Be sure to listen. That's Get Active with me, Pat Pauley, at 12 noon each Tuesday on Alternative Talk 1150.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Conversations Live is giving away books, from New York Times best-selling fiction to the latest from innovative thought leaders in business and psychology. To find out where, when, and how, like us on Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair and look out for posts titled Book Giveaway.
Listen live at 1150kknw.com. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Yeah. You keep
And welcome back, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And this, of course, is our business, careers, lifestyle, work-life balance show, third Monday of every month. And if work-life balance is eluding you right now, then my next guest has some tips that will help you get more time out of the office and more time in the play arena, however you like to play or spend your free time. Let me tell you a little bit about my guest. She's written a book called, and it's a New York Times bestseller, called Bankable Leadership, Happy People, Bottom Line Results, and the Power to Deliver Both. It's described as the ultimate step-by-step guide to unleashing your full leadership potential while keeping employees happy and generating a profit. And Dr. Tasha Urich is an organizational psychologist. She's a speaker. And as I said, she's a New York Times and USA Today bestselling author of Bankable Leadership. And in her work, she pairs the science of human behavior with a practical approach to solving leadership challenges. For more than 10 years, she's been an external consultant and a direct report to both CEOs and human resources executives in the Fortune 500 companies. And she's a regular contributor to the Huffington Post, and her expertise has been featured in the New York Times and Forbes magazine. Dr. Tasha Urich, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It is our pleasure. We're going to get some tips from you in just a moment. But before we do that, I want to just look at the book a little about why you wrote this book, because I read that you really decided to write it because you were frustrated by information that was out there. And you said it doesn't have to be so difficult. It doesn't have to be so complex. You can actually become an effective leader in the simplest way possible. And I think we all need to be, whether we're leaders at work, we need to be self-leaders. So talk to us a little bit about why you wrote the book.
That's absolutely correct. In the work that I've been doing with leaders for the past 12 years, I just heard over and over again how overwhelmed they were with the task before them. You know, whether you're a first-level supervisor or a newly appointed CEO, if you go to Amazon.com and, for example, you search leadership books, there are over 100,000 options that come back at you.
Wow.
And most leaders don't even have time to read one book every 2 months, let alone 100,000. So what I wanted to do was take what we already knew about leadership, simplify it, and provide a step-by-step guide that was kind of a practical field guide for any type of leader who knows that they could be more successful. And that's exactly what the book does.
Yeah. Well, you say there are four vital points in the book, and I'd like to discuss those because I do think they're going to lead into your tips on productivity and how we can actually get more time ourselves out of the office. Number one, for example, be human and drive performance. Tell us what you mean by that.
So the heart of the book is essentially a tension that all leaders feel between making their team happy and driving results for their business. And so those four behaviors are just, you know, examples of how that plays out. So, you know, be human versus drive performance. You might feel like you have to sacrifice treating your employees with compassion to get work out of them. Or vice versa, right? You might treat them like humans so much that you forget to actually make them produce, and really that's why you're there in the first place.
Right,
so
right.
Bankable leaders are able to do both without sacrificing one of those two things for the other.
Right. Number two, be helpful, drive responsibility. Some people might say, well, you know, how am I going to drive responsibility if I'm helping people out? But that's not what you mean, so tell us what you mean.
Exactly. The best type of leader is able to provide the conditions for an employee to succeed while also stepping away and letting them own the product of their work. You know, the worst is the tyrant or the dictator who kind of is overly prescriptive and gives too many rules and regulations. Another way that a leader can be not very helpful is by being too helpful, stepping in and fixing work when somebody makes a mistake just to save them the pain or the heartache of that. But ultimately, you know, you can't do one or the other. You can't just drive responsibility or be helpful. You have to do both. And that's, again, what bankable leadership is really about.
Right. And the third is be thankful and drive improvement.
So there's two types of leaders. If you focus on one of those things at the expense of the other, one is overly thankful. In other words, you know, you're cheering the crew of the Titanic that they're rearranging the deck chairs really successfully, where you're just being so effusive with gratitude and thanks that people start to be entitled.
Right.
On the other end is someone who, you know, nothing is ever good enough. You drive improvement so much that no one feels appreciated or recognized. And the best, most bankable leaders are able to appreciate great performance and great effort while at the same time constantly asking employees to raise the bar. And again, that's very, very possible using the tips in our book.
Yeah. And then the fourth vital point that you break this down into is be happy and drive productivity. And be happy is important. We're going to talk about bosses who are bullies in the next segment. So tell us what you mean by be happy and drive productivity.
You know, one of the statistics that just is, sort of sums this up is that 33% of people think about work from the moment they wake up. And 75% of people think about work as the last thing they remember before going to sleep at night. Mm. And we live in this sort of hyper-productive society where the level of productivity we have every day is a barometer for how important we are. And again, the best leaders are able to understand that you have to bring in a sense of happiness and fun and levity into the workplace while still making sure that people are productive at the same time.
Right, right. So you say that, you know, a lot of people say, well, good leaders are born, leaders are born. You say 70% of leadership skills are learned. So that's good news for people who think they don't have leadership skills, and especially when we're trying to be strong self-leaders. So talk to us a little bit about huge subject. Just break it down. If I'd say somebody is a good self-leader, how would you describe that? What attributes would they have?
So somebody who is a great leader, again, at the end of the day, is able to simultaneously focus on creating happy people, motivating them, treating them with compassion, and getting results for the business. And just going back to the statistic you mentioned, this is from a real empirical study that looked at how much of leadership is learned versus born. Mm-hmm. And they did find that 30% of leadership is inborn. And that makes sense, right? You look at leaders like Nelson Mandela. He had something in him that the rest of us don't sort of naturally, automatically have. But the great thing about that study, and what I think gives me a tremendous amount of hope in helping leaders be better, is that 70% of leadership is indeed learnable. And what that means is every day you have to show up at work and be open to hearing the truth about yourself, be willing to make a commitment to be better, and be committed enough to come to work every day and get better at that. And again, that's really what the book helps leaders do.
Right, right. So let's look at some productivity tips. If you're going to give somebody the top three tips on being productive at work so they can get more time to play outside or however they want to spend their free time, what would they be?
So the first tip I can give everyone is probably the most important, and that is to stop wasting time at work. We use this reasoning that I said earlier where, you know, we feel like if I spend 12 hours at work, I must be really important. But then if you think about what you do during the course of a workday, you show up, you check a couple of emails, you wander over to the cafeteria, get a cup of coffee, run into a friend, talk about the basketball game, and on it goes. And if you think about it, you know, how many hours a day are you really being productive? So my first tip is to really help you think about, what am I giving up by wasting time at work or by being idle when I could be a little bit more efficient? I'm really trying to remember that. You know, if I could leave at 5, what kind of an evening would I have with my family, with my friends? How could I relax? And make that commitment to yourself to be efficient. I think so much of our self-imposed busyness is really self-imposed. There's a lot of situations where we can, you know, make the choice to be more efficient, and get that gets us a lot of the way there.
Right, I would agree.
So that's the first tip. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say go ahead with number two.
Yes, exactly. We're going to say the same thing. So number two, this is a little bit counterintuitive, but what I always say is power breaks make us powerfully productive. So what the research tells us is that when you work, you know, 70, 80 hours a week without stopping and without breathing, your brain actually begins to function more poorly. The short end of it is we actually get stupider when we work too much. So if you think about each evening or each weekend as an example for you to unplug, to put away your phone, to put away your laptop, and actually recharge, you will, and the research tells us this, get more done in less time. So again, it's counterintuitive, and you kind of have to take a risk a little bit. But again, it's pretty remarkable what happens when you let your brain get some rest and rejuvenation.
Yeah, I can personally attest to that one. I do take power breaks.
Yeah,
interesting. I don't want to get off topic here. We'll come back to number three in a minute. But I did read the other day that part of the science behind the TED Talks and why they keep them to 18 minutes is that the average coffee break in offices is 18 minutes. So if we cut out those average coffee breaks and have the power breaks you're talking about, we'd be much better off, really.
Yeah, exactly. As long as you don't take too many coffee breaks and then you ruin, you know, your productivity during the day.
Absolutely.
You just have to be careful about how to do it.
Right, right. So number three is?
The third tip, again, it's making an investment in a way that doesn't initially make sense, but I promise it will help, and that's to exercise. One of the things that we know is that when people carve out time during their week to get some physical activity, even if it's a half an hour a day, we have less anxiety and people report less work-family conflict. And the reason the researchers think this is the case is that it helps us psychologically detach from work, even if it's for a half an hour. And again, that sort of goes back to this idea of breaks, but exercise in particular inoculates us against stress and really allows us to be as productive as possible in the shortest time possible. So think about, you know, investing 30 minutes during your next lunch break. What if you went to the gym for half of that or for 20 minutes of that and grabbed a salad or something?
Yeah, I call that my magic elixir.
Oh, I love it.
And yet, too often it is the first thing that goes if I get super busy. And I know that's, you know, totally counterproductive.
Yes, exactly.
So let's look, Dr. Urich, at ways we can, when is it okay to say no to our boss? And I just want to incorporate self-employed people in here and entrepreneurs because, you know, people who are not self-employed say, oh, it's okay for you, you can do what you want when you want. Not true. We still have clients, right? When is it okay for you to say no to your boss? Because we can't control input and we can't always control output. So talk to us about some times when it might be okay to say no.
That's a great question. I think the ability to be able to say no starts with clear expectations between you and your boss. And your boss might do this automatically, but if they don't do it, you can initiate it. And that's really to sit down with them and say, what are, you know, the top three most important activities or contributions that you expect me to make as a part of this team? And what that conversation allows you to do is to prioritize or triage the things that come into you. So if you can leave that conversation with a real clarity between you and your boss around, you know, the absolutely most important thing that person wants you to do, when they shoot something at you that isn't in those priorities or that list of priorities, it allows you to the opportunity to go back and have a conversation. And a conversation could sort of look something like this. You might sort of remind them, here were the three things we decided. I'm noticing that this new task you've assigned to me doesn't really line up with that list. And then you can get a little, you can negotiate a little and say, which of these things needs to come off? Because it sounds like maybe this is taking a precedence over the things we agreed. And essentially what you're doing there is giving your boss the notion that you can't just keep adding things onto your plate. And if you can tie it back to what are the most important things they want from you, that often becomes an opportunity not to say no, but to work together to prioritize and figure out what's most important. I think any time that you start to think about, well, I'm just going to say no to this, that can be what I call a career-limiting move.
Mm-hmm. Very.
You want to make it more of a discussion with them and a partnership conversation rather than pushing back and declining the work.
Yeah, and we want to approach it from as an objective point of view as we can.
Yeah, exactly.
Establishing boundaries is really important with bosses and coworkers. And, I told you in the next segment we're going to talk about bullying bosses. I'm sure you've run into this in your experience, too. What are some good ways from your point of view to establish boundaries with a boss who's pushing too hard?
Sure. So I'm thinking of a client of mine who I've been working with, and we've been using some of the tools in my book. And he was completely unable to take a vacation. His greatest dream was to take 5 days and go to Mexico with his family. And what would happen constantly is the boss would just keep throwing new things at him, and he would essentially have something scheduled and then have to take it off of his calendar. Mm-hmm. And it was very, very frustrating. So what he did was a couple of things. The first was to sit down and have a conversation with his boss about the impact that some of those actions were having. And it also goes back to what we talked about before with prioritizing. But to really say, you know, I feel so burnt out at this point that I'm not any good to you. And I want to make sure that we're on the same page and I'm able to do the best that I can do in my role. And the one thing that I need to do that, you know, I haven't taken a vacation in, I think it was 2 or 3 years. What would it take for me to block off 5 days? And what was really cool about that conversation is it then became sort of a joint problem-solving activity where he was able to communicate to his boss exactly what the cost was of that. And all of a sudden, his boss could understand it from a new perspective. Oh, wait a minute, you know, I'm going to get poorer results if I can't actually give him, you know, even just a week to spend with his family. So I recently heard that he had blocked off the time and scheduled the trip.
Oh, fabulous.
And again, you know, if you go back to that power breaks idea, even if you can't take a week, even if it's taking, you know, a Friday afternoon off, it goes such a long way. And to help educate your boss about the impact of not doing that sometimes can be the best way to turn that around for yourself.
Yeah, a good manager will pick up on that kind of stuff because, you know, I know we have managers and leaders out there. Years ago, a boss said to me, the CEO actually said to me, you don't look your usual perky self. And I said, I feel burned out because I'd been running on fumes. I had no staff. And he went into a room, closed the door, and he made calls and brought in the troops.
Oh, that's great.
But, of course, you've got to have the right person behind you. Yeah. One quick question before we go. When is it okay to ask for help? My first guest brought this up because he said, you know, in the military, they don't ask for help because it's the way they operate. They don't, you know, like to let on that they don't know anything. In the civilian world, of course, it's different. There are times we've got to have that help. So when is it okay?
You know, I think it's hard. I think we live in a society where asking for help is, you know, sometimes people feel like it's an indication of weakness.
Mm-hmm.
But when we're talking about the topic of how to get balance and how to leave time for yourself, the way I see it is the only way you can do that is by asking for help from other people, whether it's help in blocking off your schedule or help in, you know, letting you set boundaries or help in getting the work done. I think it's just so important to remember that asking for help is a sign of strength, and it's a commitment to your future and current well-being. And so if you can sort of reframe that, I think it becomes a totally different conversation that you have with yourself at work.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I love on your book, you say people or results, you don't have to choose. You can have both if we do it right. Dr. Tasha Urick, I want to thank you for being with us today. The book is called Bankable Leadership, Happy People, Bottom Line Results, and the Power to Deliver Both. And your website is bankableleadership.com. Is that correct?
That's correct. And the book is available online and in bookstores everywhere.
Super. Thank you so much for being with us. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
And please do stay tuned. When we come back, we'll be joined by Brian Vilcow, author of Driving to Perfection. We'll be talking about what to do when your boss is a big bully. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Big boss man. Can't you hear me when I call?
More than 100 million wild animals are killed each year illegally. Poaching is a major threat to our country's wildlife. I'm Tom Barry. I'm an actor with a desire to preserve living space for wildlife. The Humane Society Wildlife Land Trust does just that. Works with private landowners to protect wildlife, to preserve natural habitats. To learn more or to work with the Humane Society Wildlife Land Trust, call 800-729-SAVE. That's 800-729-SAVE or visit wildlifelandtrust.org. Thank you.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to the Northwest School of Animal Massage, we cover the world of animals. This week, March 16th, always entertaining Kevin McDonald and gifted medium and animal intuitive Kim Miller will host the show for me. They'll have open phone lines throughout the show. Kim can help you connect with your animal or human loved ones on this side or the other. She can also tell you why your animal friend does stuff and what to do to change unwanted behavior or illness. So give her a call on Martha Norwalk's Animal World Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL. Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.
Next week on Conversations Live, registered nurse and mother of three special needs children, Stephanie Collins joins Vicky to share tips on how families can cope with the never-ending battle for help and special needs services. We'll also hear from leading brain health expert Dr. Cynthia Green with tips to help keep your memory sharp and your mind active. That's all coming next Monday at noon Pacific time, 3 p.m. Eastern on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for upcoming show details. And podcasts.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Radio with no added hormones or preservatives. All natural, alternative talk, 1150 AM.
Can't you hear me when I call? Can't you hear me when I call? Well, you ain't so big. You know, you're just tall, that's all.
And welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and we're in our last segment of today. This is our business, careers, work-life balance show, third Monday of every month. And we're talking right now about what to do when your boss is a big bully. What do you do? And there was a study by Workplace Bullying Institute that found 27% of U.S. employees have been bullied at work. Nearly 37 million people, and more than 55% of those who were bullied said their boss was the bully. So we have Brian Vilcow joining us right now to talk about this subject. He's the author of Driving to Perfection, Achieving Business Excellence by Creating a Vibrant Company Culture. And I do think company culture has a lot to do with this. He's located in Houston, Texas. He's the began his professional career as a lawyer in 1989 after earning a BA from the University of Wisconsin and JD from the Northwestern University School of Law. He's currently president of Jetco Delivery, which is a growing trucking and cargo transportation company. Welcome to the show, Brian Vilcow.
Thank you so much, Vicky.
So I want to jump straight in here because we don't have a great deal of time, but those are some staggering numbers on bullying in the workplace. What have you personally come across in your experience in the corporate world?
Well, I think I've seen it take two general forms. Okay, what one form is you've got a rogue supervisor, somebody who's not behaving in line with the company's values and culture, and that person is engaging in conduct, bullying conduct that's just not right for the company. Then there's a second flavor, which is a deeper problem, and that's where bullying is part of the culture. And in other words, the conduct is actually accepted by the company, either overtly or tacitly. Those are the two varieties I've seen. The first one is obviously much easier to deal with. The second, when you've got that in your culture where that conduct is accepted, is much more difficult.
Yeah, I've heard it. I've been in that situation where it's management by intimidation, and you're afraid to speak up because if you do, you're seen as negative, or not a team player, not collaborative. So let's take a look at that one, because I think that one is harder to deal with. Is it just a case of if you're in that environment and it's not working for you, you feel bullied, you feel intimidated all the time, that you need to get out? Is there a way of dealing with it?
Okay, well, sure. I mean, leaving the employer is always going to be the final answer. But let's say this is a company that for one reason or another you want to stay at, but you can't stay in this environment. I really believe that the best advice is first to go direct to your supervisor and the person that you perceive is treating you unfairly or bullying you. And lay it on the line. Lay it on the line and say, look, this is what I'm seeing. This is how you treat me. Maybe this is how I see you treat others. Have that discussion. I mean, really, what do you have to lose? Especially if, you know, you're going to wind up leaving anyway. It may lead to a breakthrough discussion. I've seen plenty of people say, you know, I didn't realize that. I was so focused on this metric or that metric. I didn't realize that. And people have actually raised their game and have treated people better because of it.
Mm-hmm.
Admittedly, it may not work. If it doesn't work, you're no worse off. But you may, in the process, have helped yourself, helped your employees, and you know, retained your position as an employer that you'd otherwise like to be at.
Right. One of the things that surprised me when I was looking at, I looked at a couple of different studies that have been done fairly recently on workplace bullying. And one of the things that surprised me was that if this is ongoing and people are talking to their coworkers about it, that at some point that this one study showed that the coworkers eventually side with the manager who's doing the bullying. And one has to assume that's probably from fear, because they don't want to rock the boat. You know, this person's getting all the attention. Let them continue to get all the attention. But how can you work inside a corporation and try and turn that culture around? Huge challenge, because let's face it, corporations have their own culture.
They do have their own culture, and I think the answer really rests with what you just said, which is the team. In other words, if in fact the whole team has turned against you, so it's just not your supervisor anymore, that's much more difficult. On the other hand, if you can obtain support from your peers, from your coworkers, that we collectively have to solve this problem, this isn't acceptable, it becomes a lot easier discussion to have, because you've got strength in numbers. I've had this happen in my career where I laid my career on the line at one point, and it was sure a lot more helpful because there were two or three other like-minded people who agreed to do that with me.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, we're not accepting this particular situation. It got all the way up to the CEO, and he ultimately sided with us. We ultimately broke through and won. And so fighting that battle alone, I could have fought, but fighting it with team members it makes it easier for everybody. And there are just some lines that can't be crossed in terms of how you treat it. What I try and tell the managers I work with is be as hard as you need to be on the issue. We've got issues, we've got problems, we've got to address them, but that does not give you a license to be hard on the people personally. You've got to separate the business issue and not let it turn into personal attacks, because that's what creates that downward spiral and makes that conduct acceptable.
Right. I was looking for definitions of what we do consider workplace bullying, and it basically came back as words or actions that aren't sexual in nature, because that would be covered by sexual harassment, but words or actions that still make an employee feel uncomfortable, threatened, or intimidated. And common examples were threats of violence or blackmail, hazing of new employees, spreading rumors about coworkers. Do you have other things to add to that?
I think that's a pretty good list. Now, when I think of bullying, though, I mean, there are some things that clearly cross the line, and there's legal implications. You mentioned, you know, sexual harassment. There's other kinds of harassment. What I'm thinking about more is, are those behaviors and those conducts that don't cross that legal line, but just cross that create a toxic culture, that create a culture that ultimately nobody wants to be at, and will, at the end of the day, hurt the company's performance, production, profitability, because you've got a workforce or a subset of the workforce that's so demotivated every time they come in. I think the legal stuff is very bright line. That's right there. But it's the quieter bullying, the bullying that doesn't have a statutory protection, that I think can really suck the air out of the company and the whole organization. That's why it cannot be tolerated in a vibrant culture.
Yeah, it can't be. And it becomes pervasive if it's allowed to continue. You talk about in your book, Driving to Perfection, are your fears leading you? And some of the bullying that I've seen in my experiences as a consultant over the years, and when I used to work as an FTE in corporations, are that you have maybe inexperienced managers who are a little fearful of what's going on. They're not quite sure they're up to par, and they can come across as very harsh and intimidating and bullying because they don't have the skills to turn that around. But you talk in your book about a time in your career when you were leading by fear. I wonder if you'd talk to us a little bit about that and how you managed to change that culture around.
Well, sure. In Driving to Perfection, what I talked about is you've got to take control of your fears. Every one of us has fears, whether we're a manager, whether we're an employee, an owner of a company. And in my book, I use the example of the Great Recession. Business collapsed. We saw our neighbors being laid off, our employees saw their family members being laid off. There was a lot of uncertainty. And so what I did was made a conscious decision in that environment to announce no layoffs, to announce that we're going to get through this together as a team. And so it was an opportunity for me to take control of my fears and in the process set an example for the rest of the employees. And we actually grew through the recession. We're profitable through the recession, and I attribute that to making an investment in our culture and attacking my own fears as well as the fears of our coworkers in kind of a way that was counterintuitive at the time. Mm-hmm. It was a very good example of you can't, if you're going to lead, you can't let your fears drive you. And it goes right to this. You mentioned earlier a young manager, right? Maybe that person's insecure in his or her position. Well, that could lead to that aggressive behavior because they're trying to protect their turf.
Mm-hmm.
So, you can't be led by your fears no matter what position you're in and what you're trying to execute.
Right. So in 30 seconds, because we're almost out of time here, but in 30 seconds, can you tell me, as a manager, as a leader, how you provide a safe environment for employees?
A safe environment in terms of expressing concerns?
Yeah.
It starts at the top. I use integrity as an example, right? If you tolerate one lie, you tolerate 10,000 lies. So it's the same example here, that you've got to create an environment that does not accept that kind of behavior and that is open door. So any employee can go to anybody in the company, president, doesn't matter who, and report this concern without fear of retribution.
Right.
You cannot have fear of retribution in the organization in this type of situation.
All right.
As I said earlier, the best bet is to first try going to the person involved. Go to the supervisor. But if it doesn't work, you must have recourse with no fear of retribution whatsoever.
Right. Well, I think that's good advice. And we certainly need to stand up for ourselves. And hopefully, you know, there's a lot written about this. And hopefully people can get this resolved if they're feeling that situation. Thanks so much for being with us, Brian Philko. The book is called Driving to Perfection. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It was a true pleasure.
And you can find out more about Brian and his work at drivingtoperfection.com. That's the website there. And I have a couple of links to some other sites, too, that are helpful on bullying if you want those, if you find yourself in a bad situation. You can just email me at info@conversationslive.net. Call me at 800-495-7617. Or you can reach me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair. Until next week, we've got to rush out of here. We'll see you then. Live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.